Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations, 7 days a week here in the United States, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the lies my teacher told me, right after this. Hey, are you concerned about your privacy? Well, how much does your government know about you anyway, and how much do you want your government to know about you? Well, government only knows as much about you as you tell them about yourself. And everything that government, industry, or business knows about you is because you told them. That's right. And the Fourth Amendment protects you in your person, houses, papers, and effects. But it doesn't protect you from yourself. Now, can we have privacy in the computer age? Well, you bet we can. And that's because information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. It's knowing how much information is gathered, what information is stored, and what information you want to keep personal and private that actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, always keep in mind that no one knows anything about you that you haven't revealed by your own hand or your own mouth. Now, if you'd like to learn more about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour program. It's entertaining, it's informative, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge. It plays in any CD player. And all you have to do to call to order yours is call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or if you're online, go to the webpage. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget it. John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. The invisibility of anti-racism in American history textbooks. You know, perhaps the most telling criticism Frances Fitzgerald made in her 1979 survey of American history textbooks, the book is called America Revised, was that they leave out ideas. And as presented by textbooks of the 1970s, American political life was completely mindless, she observed. Well, why would textbook authors avoid even those ideas with which they agree? Taking ideas seriously does not fit with the rhetorical style of textbooks, which presents events so as to make them seem foreordained along a line of constant progress. Including ideas would make history contingent. Things could go either way. And as a matter of real practical fact, they have on occasion. The right people, armed with the right ideas, have not always won. And when they didn't win, the authors would be in the embarrassing position of having to disapprove of an outcome in the historical past. Including ideas would introduce uncertainty. This is not textbook style. Textbooks unfold history without real drama or suspense. Only melodrama, if that. Now, on the subject of race relations, John Brown's statement that, quote, this question is still to be settled, unquote, seems as relevant today and perhaps even as ominous today as when he spoke that statement back in 1859. The opposite of racism is anti-racism, of course, or what we might call racial idealism or equalitarianism. And it's still not clear whether that concept or idea will prevail or not. And in this struggle, our history textbooks offer little help. And just as they underplay white racism, they also neglect racial idealism. And in so doing, they deprive students of potential role models to call upon as they try to bridge the new fault lines that will spread out in the future from the great rift of our past. Now, since ideas and ideologies played an especially important role in the Civil War, American history textbooks give a very singular, inchoate view of that struggle. And just as textbooks treat slavery without racism, they treat abolitionism without any idealism. Consider the most radical white abolitionist of them all. His name? John Brown. The treatment of Brown, like the treatment of slavery and Reconstruction, has changed in American history textbooks. From about 1890 to about 1970, John Brown was regarded as and pictured as being insane. Before 1890, the history textbooks showed John Brown to be perfectly sane. And after 1970, John Brown regained his sanity again. Now, since John Brown himself did not change after his death, his sanity then proves and provides an inadvertent index of the level of white racism in our society. You see, in today's textbooks, Brown makes two appearances. The first is in Pottawatomie, Kansas, and the second in Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Recall that the 1854 Kansas-Nebraska Act tried to resolve the question of slavery through popular sovereignty. The practical result of this policy of leaving the slavery decision to whoever settled in Kansas was an ideologically motivated settlement craze. Northerners rushed to live and farm in Kansas Territory and to make it free soil. Fewer southern planters moved to Kansas with their slaves, but slave owners from Missouri repeatedly crossed the Missouri River to vote in territorial elections and to establish a reign of terror to drive out the free soil farmers. Well, in May of 1856, hundreds of pro-slavery border ruffians, as they came to be called, raided the free soil town of Lawrence, Kansas, burning down the hotel and destroying two printing presses. The American tradition describes Brown's action at Pottawatomie. In retaliation, it says, a militant abolitionist named John Brown led a midnight attack on the pro-slavery settlement of Pottawatomie. Five people were killed by Brown and his followers, unquote. Discovering American History describes Brown's 1859 Harper's Ferry raid like this. It says, quote, John Brown, the son of an abolitionist, envisioned a plan to invade the South and free the slaves. In 1859, with financial support from abolitionists, Brown made plans to start a slave rebellion in Virginia, to establish a free state in the Appalachian Mountains, and to spread the rebellion throughout the South. On October the 16th, 1859, Brown and 18 of his men captured the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry in the present state of West Virginia. He and his men were captured by a force of Marines. Brown was brought to trial and convicted of treason against Virginia, murder, and criminal conspiracy. He was hanged on December the 2nd, 1859, unquote. In all, 7 of the 12 textbooks take this neutral approach to John Brown. Their bland paragraphs don't imply that Brown was crazy, but neither do they tell enough about him to explain why he became a hero to so many blacks and non-slave-holding whites. 3 textbooks still linger in a former era. John Brown was almost certainly insane, opines the history book American History. Another book, The American Way, tells a whopper. It says, quote, later Brown was proved to be mentally ill. Unquote. The American pageant characterizes Brown as deranged, gaunt, grim, terrible, and crack-brained, probably of unsound mind, and says that 13 of his near relatives were regarded as insane, including his mother and grandmother. Two other textbooks finesse the sanity issue by calling Brown merely fanatical. No textbook has any sympathy for John Brown or takes any pleasure in his ideas or his actions. And yet it was John Brown, more than any other single American, who precipitated the Civil War. For the benefit of readers who, like me, grew up reading that Brown was at least a fanatic, if not crazed or insane, let's consider the evidence. To be sure, some of Brown's lawyers and relatives, hoping to save his neck, suggested an insanity defense. But no one who knew John Brown thought Brown to be crazy. He favorably impressed people who spoke with him after his capture, including his jailer and even reporters writing for Democratic newspapers which supported slavery. Governor Wise of Virginia called him, quote, a man of clear head, unquote, after Brown got the better of him in an informal interview. They are themselves mistaken who take him to be a madman, Governor Wise said. In his message to the Virginia legislature, he said Brown showed quick and clear perception, rational premises, and conclusive reasoning. Composure and self-possession were hallmarks of Brown's demeanor. Well, after 1890, textbook authors inferred Brown's madness from his plan, which admittedly was far-fetched. Never mind that Brown himself presently told Frederick Douglass that the venture would make a stunning impact, even if it failed. Not that his 20-odd followers can hardly all be considered crazed also. Rather, we must recognize that the insanity with which historians have charged John Brown was never psychological. It was ideological. Brown's actions made no sense to textbook writers between 1890 and 1970. To make no sense is to them to be crazy. But clearly, Brown's contemporaries did not consider Brown to be insane. Brown's ideological influence in the month before his hanging and continuing after his death was immense. He moved the boundary of acceptable thoughts and deeds regarding slavery. Before Harper's Ferry, to be an abolitionist was not quite acceptable. It was politically incorrect, even in the North. Just talking about freeing slaves, advocating immediate emancipation, was behavior at the outer limits of the ideological spectrum. By engaging in armed action, including murder, John Brown made more verbal abolitionism seem much less radical. After an initial shockwave of revulsion against Brown in the North as well as in the South, Americans were fascinated to hear what he had to say. In his 1859 trial, John Brown captured the attention of the nation like no other abolitionist or slave owner before or since, and he knew it. Brown said, "My whole life before had not afforded me one half of the opportunity to plead for what was right." In his speech to the court on November 2nd, just before the judge sentenced him to die, Brown argued, "Had I so interfered in behalf of the rich, the powerful, it would have been all right." He referred to the Bible, which he saw in the courtroom, which teaches me that all things whatsoever I would that men should do to me, I should do even to them. It teaches me further, he said, to remember them that are in bonds as bound with them. I endeavored to act up to that instruction. Brown went on to claim the high moral ground. He said, "I believe that to have interfered as I have done, as I have always freely admitted that I have done, in behalf of his despised poor, I did no wrong, but rather I did right." And although he objected that his impending death penalty was unjust, he accepted his penalty, and he pointed to grave and graver injustices. He said, "Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice, and to mingle my blood further with the blood of my children and with the blood of millions in this slave country whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments, I say, let it be done." Brown's willingness to go to the gallows for what he thought was right had a moral force of and by itself. It seems as if no man had ever died in America before, for in order to die, you must first have lived. Henry David Thoreau observed in a eulogy in Boston, Thoreau said, quote, "These men, in teaching us how to die, have at the same time taught us how to live." Thoreau went on to compare Brown with Jesus of Nazareth, who had faced a similar death at the hands of the wicked and evil state. During the rest of November, Brown provided the nation graceful instruction on how to face death. In Larchmont, New York, George Templeton Strong wrote in his diary, quote, "One's faith in anything is terribly shaken by anybody who is ready to go to the gallows condemning and denouncing it." Brown's letters to his family and friends softened his image, showing his human side, and prompted an outpouring of sympathy for his children and soon-to-be widow. If not for Brown himself, his letters to supporters and remarks to journalists widely circulated formed a continuing indictment of slavery. We see his charisma in his letter from a conservative Christian, so the author signed it "Written to Brown in Jail." "Now, while I cannot approve of all of your acts, I stand in awe of your position, Mr. Brown, since your capture, and dare not oppose you lest I be found fighting against God. For you speak as one having authority, and seem to be strengthened from on high." When Virginia executed John Brown on December 2, 1859, making him the first American since the founding of the nation to be hanged as a traitor, church bells mourned in cities throughout the North. Louisa May Alcott, William Dean Howells, Herman Melville, John Greenleaf, and Walt Whitman were among the poets who responded to the event. "The gaze of Europe is fixed at this moment on America," wrote Victor Hugo from France. "Hanging John Brown," Hugo predicted, "will open a latent fissure that will finally split the United States asunder. The punishment of John Brown may consolidate slavery in Virginia, but it will certainly shatter the American democracy. You preserve your shame, but you kill your glory." Well, this is from a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me. It's written by a fellow named James Lowen, published by the New York Press, copyrighted in 1995. It's not an outlandish or an outspoken book. It's not something that there's only one of. There are many books on history out there. But Lies My Teacher Told Me kind of reminds me of Columbus discovering America. Remember? We all learned that in school. Columbus discovered America. What they never explained was the people who greeted him on the beach. What did they discover? Well, it would seem like to me that the discovery of America was done by the natives, doesn't it to you? Hang on, I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. Closer to home, state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents, and every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how government, banking, insurance, business, and industry obtains all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for anyway? Well, knowing how this information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, for more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. And let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. That number again, 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about John Brown. Lies My Teacher Told Me, published by New York Press, written by James Lowen. Well, Brown remained controversial after his death. The Republican congressmen kept their distance from his felonious acts. Nevertheless, Southern slave owners were appalled at the show of Northern sympathy for Brown, and they resolved to maintain slavery by any means necessary, including quitting the Union if they lost the next election. Brown's charisma in the North, meanwhile, was not spent only increased, it was only increased, rather, due to what many came to view as his martyrdom. As the war came, and as thousands of Americans found themselves making the same commitment to face death that John Brown had made, the force of his example took on new relevance. And that's why soldiers marched into battle singing John Brown's Body. 2 years later, church congregations sang Julia Ward Howe's new words to the song, "As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free," in Battle Hymn of the Republic. And the identification of John Brown and Jesus Christ took another turn. The next year saw the 54th Massachusetts Colored Regiment parading through Boston to the tune en route to its historic destiny with death in South Carolina. While William Lloyd Garrison surveyed the cheering bystanders from a balcony, his hand was resting on a bust of John Brown. In 1865, another Massachusetts Colored Regiment marched to that tune through the streets of Charleston, South Carolina. Now, that was the high point of old John Brown. At the turn of the century, around 1900, as southern and border states disenfranchised African Americans, as lynchings proliferated, as blackface minstrel shows came to dominate American popular culture, white America abandoned the last shards of its racial idealism. A history published in 1923 makes plain the connection to Brown's insanity. It says, quote, "The farther we get away from the excitement of 1859, the more we are disposed to consider this extraordinary man the victim of mental delusions," unquote. It wasn't until the civil rights movement of the 1960s, which was when white America freed from enough of its racism to accept that a white person did not have to be crazy to die for black equality. In a sense, the murders of Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Goodman in Mississippi, James Reeb and Viola Liuzu in Alabama, and various other white civil rights workers in various other southern states during the civil rights period in the 1960s liberated textbook writers to see sanity again in John Brown. In The Rise of the American Nation, written in 1961, the book calls the Harper's Ferry plan a wild idea which was certain to fail. While in Triumph of the American Nation, published in 1986, the plan becomes a bold idea but almost certain to fail. Frequently in American history, the ideological needs of white racists and black nationalists coincide. And so it was with their views of John Brown. During the heyday of the Black Power movement, I listened to speaker after speaker in a Mississippi forum denounce whites. "They are your enemies," thundered one black militant. "Not one white person has ever had the best interests of black people at heart," said another. John Brown sprang to my mind, but the speaker anticipated my objection. And he said, "You might say John Brown did, but remember, he was crazy. John Brown might provide a defense against such global attacks on whites, but unfortunately, American history textbooks have erased Brown as a usable character because he's branded as being insane." No black person who met John Brown thought Brown was crazy, and many black leaders of that day, Martin Delaney, Henry Highland Garnett, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, and many others, knew and respected Brown. Only illness kept Tubman from joining Brown at Harper's Ferry in the attack. The day of his execution, black-owned businesses closed in mourning across the North. Frederick Douglass called Brown one of the greatest heroes known to African fame. A black college deliberately chose to locate at Harper's Ferry, and in 1918, its alumni dedicated a memorial stone to John Brown and his men to commemorate their heroism. The stone stated in part that this nation might have a new birth of freedom, that slavery should be removed forever from American soil. John Brown and his 21 men gave their lives for that cause. Quite possibly, textbooks should not portray this murderer as a hero, although other murderers, from Christopher Columbus to Nat Turner, get the heroic treatment. However, the flat prose that textbooks use for Brown is not really neutral. Textbook authors' withdrawal of sympathy from Brown is perceptible. Their tone in presenting Brown is much different from the tone that they employ for almost everybody else. We see this, for instance, in their treatment of his religious beliefs. You see, John Brown was a serious Christian, well read in the Bible, who took its moral commands to heart. And yet our textbooks do not credit Brown with religiosity. Subtly, they blame him for it. Believing himself commanded by God to free the slaves, Brown came up with this scheme. In the words of the book Land of Promise, the land the great American pageant calls Brown narrowly ignorant, perhaps a euphemism for overly religious and God's angry man. He believed that God had commanded him to free the slaves by force, states the textbook American History. Now, God never commanded Brown in the sense of giving him instructions. Rather, Brown thought deeply about the moral meaning of Christianity, and he decided that slavery was incompatible with it. He was also not narrowly ignorant, having traveled widely in the United States, England, and Europe. And he talked with many American intellectuals of his day, both black and white. So by way of comparison, let's consider Nat Turner, who in 1831 led the most important slave revolt since the United States became a nation. John Brown and Nat Turner both killed whites in cold blood. Both were religious. But unlike Brown, Turner saw visions and heard voices. In most textbooks, Turner has become something of a hero. Several textbooks call Turner deeply religious. None call him a religious fanatic. They reserve that term for John Brown. The closest that any textbook comes to suggesting that Turner might have been crazy is this passage from American History. It says, "Historians still argue about whether or not Turner was insane, but the author immediately goes on to qualify by saying, the point is that nearly every slave hated bondage. Nearly all were eager to see something done to destroy the system. Thus, even American history emphasizes the political and social meaning of Turner's act, not its psychological genesis in an allegedly questionable mind." The textbook's withdrawal of sympathy from Brown is also apparent in what they include and what they exclude about his life before Harper's Ferry. In the 1840s, Brown somehow got interested in helping black slaves, according to American Adventures. Brown's interest is no mystery. He learned it from his father, who was a trustee of Oberlin College, a center of abolitionist sentiment. If Adventures wanted, it could have related the well-known story about how young John Brown made friends with a black boy during the War of 1812, which convinced Brown that blacks were not inferior. Instead, the textbook's sentence reads like a slur. Textbook authors make Brown's Pottawatomie killings seem equally unmotivated by neglecting to tell that the violence in Kansas had hitherto been perpetrated primarily by the pro-slavery side. Indeed, slavery sympathizers had previously killed 6 free soil settlers. Several years before Pottawatomie, at another location in Kansas, Brown had helped 35 free soil men defend themselves against several hundred marauding pro-slavery men from Missouri, thereby earning the nickname Osawatomie John Brown. Not one textbook mentions that Brown did or what Brown did at Osawatomie, where he was the defender, not the offender. But 8 of the 12 textbooks tell what he did at Pottawatomie, where he was the attacker. Now, you know, our textbooks also handicap John Brown by not letting him speak for himself. Even his jailer let John Brown put pen to paper. American History includes 3 important sentences. American Adventure gives us almost 2 sentences, and the American Pageant reprints 3 sentences from a letter that Brown wrote to his brother. The other 9 books do not provide even a phrase. Brown's words, which moved a nation, therefore do not move students today. Textbook authors have an additional reason to avoid Brown's ideas. They're tinged with Christianity. Religion has been one of the great inspirations and explanations of human enterprise in this country, and yet textbooks, while they may mention religious organizations such as the Shakers or Quakers or Christian Science, they never treat religious ideas in any period seriously. An in-depth portrayal of Mormonism, Christian Science, or Methodism of the Great Awakening would be controversial and politically incorrect. Mentioning atheism or deism would be even worse. Are you going to tell kids that Thomas Jefferson didn't believe in Jesus? Not me, a textbook editor exclaimed to me one time. Treating religious ideas neutrally, non-religiously, simply as factors in society will not do either, for that would likely offend some adherents. The textbook solution is to leave out religious ideas entirely. Quoting John Brown's courtroom words, he said, "Whatsoever I would that men should do to me, I should do even to them," would violate that taboo. So it's left out of the textbooks. Ideological contradiction is terribly important in history. Ideas have power. The ideas that motivated John Brown and the example that he set lived on long after his body lay a moldering in his grave. Yet American history textbooks give us no way to understand the role that ideas have played in our past. Conceivably, textbook authors ignore John Brown's ideas because in their eyes, his violent acts make him ineligible for sympathetic consideration. When we turn from Brown to Abraham Lincoln, we shift from one of the most controversial to one of the most venerated figures in American history. Textbooks describe Abraham Lincoln with sympathy, of course. Nonetheless, they also minimize Lincoln's ideas, especially on the subject of race. In life, Abraham Lincoln wrestled with the race question more openly than any other president, except perhaps Thomas Jefferson, and unlike Jefferson, Lincoln's actions sometimes matched his words. Most of our textbooks today say nothing about Lincoln's internal debate. If they did show it, what teaching devices they would become. Students would clearly see that speakers modify their ideas to appease and then to appeal to different audiences. So we cannot simply take their statements literally. If textbooks recognize Lincoln's racism, students would learn that racism not only affects Ku Klux Klan extremists, but has been normal throughout our entire history. And as they watched Lincoln struggle with himself to apply American democratic principles across the color line, students would see how ideas can develop and how a person can grow. In conversation, Lincoln, like most whites of his century, referred to blacks as niggers. When responding to Stephen Douglas's race baiting in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Lincoln himself sometimes descended into explicit white supremacy. "I have no purpose," Lincoln said, "to introduce political and social equality between the white and black races. There's a physical difference between the two, which in my judgment will probably forever forbid their living together upon the same footing of perfect equality, and inasmuch as it becomes a necessity that there must be a difference, I, as well as Judge Douglas, am in favor of the race to which I belong having the superior position." Only one textbook quotes this passage. One textbook out of 12. All of the rest, the other 11, censor Lincoln's racist ideas as they censored Douglas's. All right, we're reviewing a book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, by James Loewen. Copyrighted 1995, published by the New York Press. As I mentioned earlier, we believe what we read. We believe what our teachers tell us. We believe what our textbooks espouse. We are, in short, the net sum total of all that we've heard, all that we've seen, and all that we know. That's what we believe. Well, hang on. We'll be back with more on Lies My Teacher Told Me right after this. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. but we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? And that bonds are the exact opposite to private property, and business licenses, these public business licenses, are the exact opposite to private rights? Permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level, from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot that we can do, and the first step is to inform ourselves as to the legal alternatives that we have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first, and then let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're doing a little review here on history. History. Lies that my teacher told me. If you, like I, went to the public school system, you learned a lot of lies. And it takes a lot longer to unlearn the lies than it does to learn the truth to start with. That's always been my experience. Well, a fellow by the name of James Lowen wrote a pretty neat book. It's called Lies My Teacher Told Me. We're looking at the John Brown, Abraham Lincoln examples of lies that we learned in school that it takes a lot of time, effort, and energy to unlearn and then learn the truth. Take Abraham Lincoln, for instance. You know, Lincoln's attitudes about race were more complicated than Douglas's. The day after the Lincoln-Douglas debates declared for white supremacy in Chicago, saying the issues were distinctly drawn, Lincoln replied and indeed drew the issue very distinctly. Lincoln said, "I should like to know if taking this old Declaration of Independence, which declares that all men are equal upon principle, and making exceptions to it, where will it stop? If one man says that it does not mean a Negro, then why does not another say that it does not mean some other man? If that declaration is not true, let us hear it out. Let us stick to it then. Let us stand firmly by it then." No textbook ever quotes this passage, and every book but one leaves out Lincoln's thundering summation of what his debates with Douglas were all about. And that is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself shall be silent. It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. Lincoln's realization of the basic humanity of African Americans may have derived from his father, who moved the family to Indiana partly because he disliked the racial slavery that was sanctioned in Kentucky. Or it may stem from an experience that Lincoln had on a steamboat trip in 1841, in which he recalled years later when writing to a friend, Josh Speed. He said, "You may remember as well as I do that from Louisville to the mouth of the Ohio River, there were on board 10 or 12 slaves shackled together with irons. That sight was continual torment to me, and I see something like it every time I touch the Ohio River or any other slave border." Lincoln concluded that the memory still had the power of making me miserable, No textbook ever quotes this letter written by Abraham Lincoln. As early as 1835, in his first term in the Illinois House of Representatives, Lincoln cast one of only five votes opposing a resolution that condemned abolitionists. Textbooks imply that Lincoln was nominated for president in 1860 because he was a moderate on slavery. But in fact, Republicans chose Lincoln over frontrunner William H. Seward, partly because of Lincoln's rock-solid anti-slavery beliefs, while Seward was considered a compromiser. As president, Abraham Lincoln understood the importance of symbolic leadership in proving and in improving race relations. For the first time, the United States exchanged ambassadors with Haiti and Liberia. In 1863, Lincoln desegregated the White House staff, which initiated a desegregation of the federal government that lasted until Woodrow Wilson. Lincoln reopened the White House to black collars, notably Frederick Douglass, and he also continued to wrestle with his own racism, asking aides to investigate the feasibility of deporting, euphemistically termed colonizing, African Americans back to Africa or Latin America. Six of the 12 textbooks mentioned that Lincoln opposed slavery. Two even quote his 1864 letter, which says, quote, "If slavery isn't wrong, then nothing is wrong," unquote. However, most textbooks and the authors take pains to separate Lincoln from undue idealism about slavery. They venerate Lincoln mainly because he saved the Union. By far, their favorite statement of Lincoln's, quoted or paraphrased by 9 of the 12 books, is his letter of August 22, 1862 to Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. He said, quote, "If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save the Union by freeing all of the slaves, I would do that also. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I'd also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save this Union. And what I forbear because I do not believe it would help to save the Union. I have here stated my purpose according to my view of official duty, and I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free," unquote. Now, most textbooks do not let students see all of the above quotation. Seven of the 9 leave out the last sentence. Thus, they present a Lincoln who was morally indifferent to slavery and certainly did not care about black people. Ironically, this is also the Lincoln whom black nationalists present to African Americans to persuade them to stop thinking so well of Lincoln. Every historian knows that the fragment of Lincoln's letter to Greeley that most textbooks supply does not represent his intent regarding slavery. Lincoln wrote the letter to seek support for the war from northern supporters of slavery. He aimed it not at Greeley, who wanted slavery to end, but at anti-war Democrats, anti-black Irish Americans, governors of the border states, and the many Republicans who opposed emancipating the slaves. Saving the Union had never been Lincoln's sole concern, as shown by his 1860 rejection of the 11th hour Crittenden Compromise, a constitutional amendment intended to preserve the Union by preserving slavery forever. Every textbook writer knows that a month before Lincoln wrote to Greeley, he had presented the Emancipation Proclamation to his cabinet as an irreversible decision. But no textbook makes that clear. Not one textbook explains the political context or the intended audience for the Greeley letter. Nor does a single textbook quote Lincoln's encouragement that same summer to Unitarian ministers to go home and try to bring the people to your views, because we shall need all of the anti-slavery feeling in the country and more. And if they did, students might understand that indifference was not Abraham Lincoln's only response to the issue of slavery in America. When textbooks discuss the Emancipation Proclamation, they explain Lincoln's actions in real politic terms. By September of 1862, says Triumph of the American Nation, Lincoln had reluctantly decided that a war fought at least partly to free the slaves would win European support and lessen the dangers of foreign intervention on the side of the Confederacy. Triumph has forgotten its own earlier judgment, where they said, quote, President Lincoln had long believed slavery to be wrong, for if Lincoln opposed slavery, why would he emancipate reluctantly and merely for reasons related to international politics? To be sure, international and domestic political concerns did impinge on Abraham Lincoln, master politician that he was. But so did considerations of right and wrong. Political analysts then, as well as now, believe that Lincoln's September 1862 announcement of emancipation cost Republicans the control of Congress the following November, because Northern white public opinion would not evolve to favor black freedom for another year. Textbook authors suppress the possibility that Lincoln acted at least in part because he thought that it was right. From Indian Wars to slavery to Vietnam, textbook authors not only sidestep putting questions of right and wrong to our past actions, but they even avoid acknowledging that Americans of the time had to make those decisions concerning right and wrong. Abraham Lincoln was one of the great masters of the English language, like Winston Churchill, and perhaps more than any other president, he invoked and manipulated powerful symbols in his speeches to move public opinion, often on the subject of race relations and slavery. Textbooks, in keeping with their habit of telling everything in the authorial monotone, drivel out Lincoln's words 3 and 4 at a time. The only complete speech or letter any of them provide is the Gettysburg Address, and only 4 of the 12 textbooks dispense even that. Lincoln's 3 paragraphs at Gettysburg comprise one of the most important speeches ever given in America, and take up only 1/4 of a page in the textbooks that do include them. Nonetheless, 5 books do not even mention Lincoln's Gettysburg Address speech, while 3 others provide only the last sentence or phrase from it. That is, government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Now, Lincoln understood that fighting a war for freedom was ideologically more satisfying than fighting simply to preserve a morally neutral union. To save the Union, it was necessary to find rationales for the war other than to save the Union. At Gettysburg, he provided just that connection. Lincoln was a fine lawyer who knew full well that the United States was conceived in slavery, for the Constitution specifically treats slavery in at least 3 places. Nevertheless, he began 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Thus, Lincoln wrapped the Union cause in the rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence, which emphasized freedom even while many of its signers were slave owners. And in so doing, Lincoln was at the same time using the Declaration to redefine the Union cause, suggesting that it ultimately implied equal rights for all Americans, regardless of race. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, Lincoln continued, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. Again, Lincoln knew better. You see, by 1863, other nations had joined us in democracy. And for that matter, every European nation and most American nations had outlawed slavery. So how did our Civil War test whether they could endure? Well, here Lincoln was wrapping the Union cause in the old last best hope of mankind cloak, a secular version of the idea of a special covenant between the United States and God. Although bad history, such rhetoric makes for great speeches. The president thus appealed to the anti-war Democrats of the North to support the war effort for the good of all mankind. After invoking a third powerful symbol, the brave men living and dead who struggled here, Lincoln closed by identifying the cause for which so many had died, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. To what freedom did he refer? Black freedom. Of course, as Lincoln well knew, the war itself was undermining slavery, for what began as a war to save the Union increasingly had become a war for black civil liberties. Citizens at the time understood Lincoln perfectly. Indeed, throughout this period, Americans purchased copies of political speeches, read them, discussed the issues, and voted at rates that now seem impossibly high. The Chicago Times, a Democratic newspaper, denounced the address precisely because of the proposition that all men are created equal. The Union dead, claimed the Times, were men possessing too much self-respect to declare that Negroes were their equals or were entitled to equal privileges. Textbooks need not explain Lincoln's words at Gettysburg as I have done. The Gettysburg Address is rich enough to survive various analyses, but of the four books that do reprint the speech in its entirety, three merely put it in a box by itself in a corner of the page. Only Life and Liberty asks intelligent questions about it. As a result of this, I have yet to meet a high school graduate who has devoted any time to thinking about Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Even worse is textbook treatment of Lincoln's second inaugural. In this towering speech, one of the masterpieces of American oratory, Lincoln specifically identified differences over slavery as the primary cause of the Civil War, and in its fourth bloody year, he said, "If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which have continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to them by whom the offense came. Shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him?" Lincoln continued in this vein by invoking the doctrine of predestination, a more vital element of the nation's idea system than any that we have today. Lincoln believed in God, and he wasn't ashamed to use the name of God in his speeches, even his inaugural address. All right, we're reviewing a book called Lies That My Teacher Told Me. We'll be back with more next time. It's written by James Lohman. You can probably buy it in any bookstore. Copyrighted 1995, published by New York Press. Lies My Teacher Told Me. Hey, we're going to have to leave it right about there. You've been listening to The Law Hour and the Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's a signal says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.